Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
You're listening to New Books in Geography, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host for today, Stentor Danielson, from the Department of Geography, Geology, and the Environment at Slippery Rock University. Today, I'll be talking to Stephanie C. Kane, author of Just One Rain Away, The Ethnography of River City Flood Control, published last year by McGill-Queen's University Press. Dr. Kane, welcome to the show.
Hi, Stentor. Thanks for inviting me. Glad to be here.
So to start off, why don't you tell our listeners a bit about your background and how you came to write this book?
Okay, I've been thinking I could start a lot of places in this story, but I'm a professor of international studies at Indiana University in Bloomington, Indiana, and my early foundation is in biology and ecology, but I pivoted into cultural anthropology between my master's and doctorate while doing my first fieldwork project in the Amazon when I was recording birds and frogs. In the decades since, I've developed an experimental ethnographic method to focus on the mix of and the tensions between scientific and cultural ideas as they emerge in specific place-based situations. So my new book, Just One Rain Away, the aim is really to shift our understanding about what humans are on this planet as actors. And it's also to work against this tendency that in the midst of crisis, we grasp for engineering solutions that are presumed to be in a domain of technicality that's separate from social and political discussion or open to publics. So I think about climate change in particular in a different way than most people, I think. And I think of it as the intersection of historical and geological time, because we as humans have changed the planet radically and holistically. We are actually geological actors. So our histories are suddenly interacting with the geological processes of the planet. So when you think about those geological scale charts, you know, we're like the piece at the top. Suddenly we're pivoting that. We're an actor in that. So we are geological actors, and as such, we are unintentional actors in that we did not intend to cause climate change. And as much as we think that we intend things, and that's what makes us human, that we're rational and we intend things, what we're in the midst of now is not created by our intentionality, but by our unintentionality. And I really want to understand the relationship between cities as human collectives and rivers as alive, as water bodies that are entangled and communicating with human beings. I'll just say one more thing about this project. It grew out of what I call my port city projects, where I went to various port cities. And originally what I was trying to do was understand social and cultural life from the material edge of globalization. So in other words, to kind of be on the ground of globalization. And there I developed this way of working where every city was structured by three water infrastructures: potable water, sewage, and drainage. And I used that infrastructural model to then go to different places, and they had more or less the same kind of infrastructure, and look at the social and cultural diversity that inhabited particular geographies, and use these infrastructures. But when I got to Winnipeg, and it's funny, I said Port City Projects, and Winnipeg is in the geographical center of North America. And it's a very puzzling place in the sense that, you know, why did people put the city here in the first place? It's in the middle of a vast flood bowl that drains the continent. So flooding is very much part of its history, and they actually are very good at flood control. And so it was a good place to look at this moment of climate change crisis, especially around flooding rivers, and try to understand what engineers and scientists and inhabitants were facing and how people were thinking about changing 20th century infrastructure into 21st century infrastructure. So then I'll say one more thing. As when I did all the other Port City projects, I imagined this triple infrastructure of water, sewage, and drainage. I used that as the empirical baseline against which I did an ethnography that kind of filled in reality with sociality and culture and how people use water bodies. But in the Winnipeg case, I flipped it, and I'm thinking about science and engineering and the people who are experts in it as cultural themselves, and science knowledge and engineering knowledge and constructions as cultural artifacts that shape the way cities are built and people are on this planet. So that's my intro.
All right. Yeah, and you started to kind of answer what was going to be my next question, which is, you know, why Winnipeg? Why focus your study on this city? And one of the things I found really interesting was the way you say that, you know, part of the identity of Winnipeg almost is the idea that they're good at flood control now, that they've kind of got that figured out, that that's become, like, you know, part of what the city's all about. And then there's this question that kind of runs through the book about, you know, is their model so good that it should now be exported, like other cities should follow the Winnipeg model because it works so well for them. So can you talk a little bit about that idea that, you know, people in Winnipeg think they've got it figured out?
Yeah. Until the 2011 and the 2014 flood of the Assiniboine River. So the Winnipeg sits at the intersection of two floodplains, one from the Red River, which comes up from the Dakotas across the U.S. border, and the Assiniboine, which comes from the west, from that state over there, Saskatchewan. And so it's sitting in this intersection, but the Assiniboine was always thought of as a kind of squirrely, smaller river, and most of the major infrastructure is on the Red River, because the Red River is gigantic compared to the Assiniboine River. So you have this amazing floodway. So the waters boo when they flood in the spring and the ice melts and all the water is rushing up. There's a floodway at the south end of the city that diverts the water around into a ditch, a giant ditch that goes all around the city and dumps out on the other side of into the river on the other side of the city in the north. And that's pretty amazing. So yes, their infrastructure is amazing. But in the 2011 and 2014 floods, things were happening in the rivers that were not traditionally consistent with the history of hydrology in the region. So the Assiniboine was flooding in the summer. So everything really was organized around ice melt and snow melt, and so the infrastructure is built to deal with the spring. And with climate change, and we're finding this, we're having rain floods, and that just changed the whole equation. So when I was there in 2014, it was after those two floods, and I used those two floods to like think about how Winnipeg is both great at flood control and is also really challenged by climate change. And there's one more important dimension to that, and that is the whole notion of why is Winnipeg sitting there in the first place, and why do people go there to this place where rivers flood, and that's what rivers do, and then decide that they want to make it dry and build these divisions between land and water everywhere. And that's where you get into the settler colonial dimension of engineering, which started in the 19th century and, of course, dispossessed Indigenous peoples. So at that time, the settlers in Winnipeg started doing things that destroyed Indigenous peoples' ways of life, and they could basically do anything they wanted. And that infrastructure from colonial days still underlies the modern system. And so even though there are much better laws in Canada that protect the Indigenous nations, the colonial infrastructure underneath is still there. And I think that's probably true everywhere where there's modern engineering in the world. And that's why Winnipeg is a really good place to think through the positives and negatives of the models that we're working with, how they work, and who gets disadvantaged by the systems.
Okay, and so you talked a little bit there about the floods in 2011 and 2014 that are, you know, significant to the story you're telling. But the sort of way those floods worked out comes against the background of several other notable past floods. So you had 1997, you have 1950, and then you even go back to the end of the last ice age with what you call the outburst quartet. So could you kind of talk us through a bit of this history? How did some of these past floods shape Winnipeg and kind of set the stage for what happened with those more recent floods?
Okay. So maybe we should start with the geoscience stuff, which modelers, geoscientific modeling, has created this history that goes back to the end of the last ice age. So let me just go back to the ice age. So that's our last big climate change. And that series of events, water events, shaped the surface of North America as we know it today. So it's a good starting point, especially if you want to think about humans interacting with rivers and with everybody intertwined being geological actors. So before people, the glaciers moved down. And then when they started to recede, they started to melt and pull back. And the glaciers were melting. And remember, the topography is like low in the center, in the middle of the continent. And the melting waters just kind of filled the center. And it became this vast lake, which was named Lake Agassiz by a geologist named Upa. And so it... Then you had this vast lake, right? And it kept getting bigger and bigger because the icebergs didn't melt all at once. And so where it might have gone out, it was blocked by the ice until it burst out. And it burst out in four big moments going in the different directions towards the different oceans. And so you have one going towards the Mackenzie, one going towards the Arctic North Atlantic, and another going out what's now the St. Lawrence Seaway, that way towards the Atlantic, and one going into the Gulf. And those outbursts were fresh water, right? Ice from the snow, from the glaciers. And so all that fresh water went into the oceans, and actually the hypothesis is that it changed the very ocean currents and into the currents that we know today to be on the planet. It also... When it drained Lake Agassiz, it left the Red River. So the Red River is like the bottom of that, is what's left, the channel that's left, that was the kind of bottom of that northward push towards the Arctic. And the Assiniboine is a river that was there before the glaciers, and then when the glaciers came and Lake Agassiz got bigger and bigger, it formed a delta, and the river kind of had a lot of different pathways through geological time, eventually settling into the historical pathway that we have today. And now I'm forgetting what the question was, but that's the background. Oh, yeah. So the floods. So the 1997 flood and the 1950 flood before it, these are the great floods, right? That in 1950, they had to completely evacuate Winnipeg because the flood overwhelmed it. And this is the Red River, the big Red River, and when it comes up out of its banks and flows over the prairie, there's nothing to stop it. It just keeps going and going and going, and it becomes a sea. And if you look at photographs, the only thing you'll see are the roads and the railroad embankments that are perhaps above the landscape. So it was after 1950 that the city got together and decided they really needed to build their flood control infrastructure to save the city. And that's when they built the floodway and what's called the Portage Diversion, which we can talk about later, and the Shelmuth Dam. All of that was a result of the 1950 disaster. And then in 1997, all that infrastructure was in place, so it was a test. And in 1997, it was also a gigantic flood, but the system held, but it just held. So it's kind of cluing everyone in. Also a Red River flood with participation by the Assiniboine both times, but basically a Red River flood. Those were really the last two major floods that were Red River floods.
Okay. So then sort of bringing in the kind of theory that you're building for us, one of the concepts that you use to understand how this is all working is geoculture. So can you tell us what is geoculture and how does it play a role in understanding flooding in Winnipeg?
Okay. So, geology is, mostly about rocks and water and things that are thought of as not alive. And geopolitics, I'm in international studies, so geopolitics is very much about nation states and how they divvy up the planet. I want geoculture to be about the interpretive frameworks that we use to understand our human or humanimal relationship to the surface of the planet. And so that would include everything we do, like flood control, that manifest our desire to control and shape the surface of the planet in interaction with water bodies. So I keep the dash in there because I think I really want to keep the science clear and the engineering clear. And I want to show that culture is active and also a shaper. So how we approach each other and how we build cities, that's a cultural thing. And I'm folding the geology into the culture. But I don't want to mush it together.
Yeah. And I think that's a sort of an interesting point because a lot of times people talk about wanting to, blur all the boundaries between everything. And it was interesting that you were insisting that, no, you want to keep the hyphen between geo and culture.
It's like everybody talks about entanglement all the time. I'm like constantly trying to, okay, it's entangled. Let's disentangle it and figure out what's going on. So, anyway. Yeah, it's a bee in my bonnet.
Yeah, I mean, it's the old lumpers and splitters thing, I guess. We're in kind of a moment where people are trying to emphasize all the connections. And, at some point we need to say, oh, well, there are differences too. You got to see that other side of it.
I see. I think, I don't want to really mush everything together like a lumper, but I also don't want to split everything apart like people who just love categories and categorizing everything. I want to create this dynamic space. So I really want the dash to be where my analysis is.
Yeah, yeah.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Okay, so then, you know, we all know that the map is not identical to the territory, but that gap between cartography and on-the-ground experience is something that comes up a lot in your book. So can you talk a bit about how that difference between what we see on the map and what we see on the ground shapes your analysis in your case?
Yeah, because I think I discovered something about a kind of realm of the political unconscious or the subconscious in relation to water. And it was because of the use of maps. So I start out by saying how I love the map library here. And whenever I start a new project, I go and I collect all these giant paper maps from the old days and I lay them all around my room. So by the time I get to the field, I have this map in my head. And all these maps, of course, had the boundary between the United States and Canada most prominently, and the rivers running from north to south, from south to north and north. Okay, I'm getting confused here. So let me just let me go into the place so that I can kind of orient myself. So I'm living near the Red River, and I walk in this park, which is a park because they reserved it because it floods from the river. And I walk there every day, and I think about it, and I don't really understand what I'm seeing on the surface of the water, because I'm thinking, well, wow, this river is supposed to flow north, right? I have these international models, these continental scale models in my mind, but yet all the ripples on the water, you know, seem to be confused. They're not necessarily in resonance with the wind, and they don't seem to be in the direction that one would expect from a river that's flowing from south to north. And I ask various people, you know, along the way, how come the river looks like this? And, you know, people shrug because they don't think about that stuff. But finally, one lady stops and says, "'Cause you know, my dear, the river bend here is going from east to west, not south to north, right?" Which, of course, is obvious, but I really didn't think about it because I was acting and thinking with this international scale model in my head. So that's one aspect of it, that we travel to places and we're strangers and we come with these kind of assumptions that are completely unconscious, and we don't get things, or most of us don't even think things through about that because we're not really, we got our own business to attend to and we're not thinking about the water. So that's one thing. And the other thing about this north to south, south to north, the direction of the river that was a conundrum that was revealing to me, was that when I talked to the engineers and flood forecasters, and they would explain how everything worked, and it worked, of course, the system works around and with ice. So the thing about the Red River and flooding is that because the river is coming from the Dakotas, where it's warmer than Winnipeg because it's more south, the river is melting. It's melting in the south and moving north. So when it gets to Winnipeg, and Winnipeg is still frozen, the river is still frozen, it forms an obstacle to that water rushing up. And so when it hits the ice, especially which forms around bridges, at the footings of bridges and some bends, when it hits that, it creates problems. And so they have all kind of ways of dealing with that. So the thing is, as I was listening to them, I understood what they were telling me, but in the back of my mind, there was this confusion. I was always kind of having to make a translation in my mind from the river that flows north, from south to north, to my predisposition or my habit of thinking that rivers flow south, north to south, because I have spent most of my life in the Mississippi River Basin. So for me, rivers go from north to south. So here's an example of where we consciously know something, but unconsciously we're really thinking about something else. So I think those kinds of predispositions to think in certain ways as we, as bodies, move around space is a kind of cultural orientation that's not explored ever. So I was surprised by it and interested. And it's probably related to map making in all kinds of situations that could be looked into more deeply.
Yeah, definitely. So in one of your earlier answers, you made reference to the fact that you're writing this book as kind of an ethnography, but it's also kind of a little bit of unusual ethnography because it's not mostly populated with people. You know, the characters in the ethnography are a lot of other kinds of entities besides just people that you might find in like a classic ethnography. So can you tell us a bit about your methods for constructing the book and how you use this ethnographic approach that's a little different from a typical ethnography?
Yeah. So basically, I feel like a lot of anthropology and sociology and cultural geography focuses a lot on people who are arguing with each other about how to do things. And I kind of lost patience with that. And I understand the dangers of thinking about humanity or humanimals as a species writ large, because it erases all the differences and inequalities and acts of dispossession that have come before, and that people have different places in the social realm. But I wanted to flip the perspective so that I'm trying to be a river. I'm trying to understand humans as a river. And so as a river, I'm flowing towards Winnipeg, and I meet Winnipeg, and I meet the infrastructure and the shape. And so it's a collective. So I don't really care as a river that people are doing this or that or talking about this or that. It's the physicality of it. So really, I want to give agency to the river. And I also want to think about humans in relation to all the other elements and beings on the planet. So this is part of both the what's called new materialism and more than human studies, where we're trying to decenter the human in the way we understand our role, right? To stand outside of ourselves by putting ourselves in the position of these other beings, or sometimes thought of as things. And that's why science is so important, because that's scientific knowledge is really what enables me in the book to try to inhabit and imagine what it would be like to be a river or a diatom or a bird, and have to encounter humans and human cities.
Yeah, so I want to pick up on your mention of diatoms there, because that was, I found that really interesting as one of the, you know, non-human, more than human characters in the book. It's not one that I think most of us think about very much, and certainly not something that I expected to be a big component of a book about flooding. So can you tell us, you know, first, what are diatoms, and then, you know, why are they important enough to get, you know, their whole own chapter in this book?
Well, I have to say that before I start getting into the beautiful architecture of diatoms, that my method is rather serendipitous. I like to play with my materials. So field work and data collection took place over a 4-month period. But then for the next many years, I've worked with these materials and I've talked to people about them. And so I go through all kinds of different relational settings that lead me to think about things in a certain way. So the diatom situation came about because I have a friend and colleague, Jaya Savitsky, who's a geoscience modeler and my geoscience guru. And so I wrote him an email, and I was thinking about water bodies and thinking that, well, how do you define the difference between a river and lake? And so he wrote me a short email, which had a lovely way to think about the difference. But what really struck me was just the phrase in his email. And it was that when that lakes are places where diatoms, if they rush in from a river and they wind up in a lake, the lake's clear waters allow them to just hang out and catch the sunlight in their silica, their delicate silica open lacy structure, and convert that sunlight into food for fishes and zooplankton. So they're primary producers. But the idea was that the river is rushing and it's muddy and it's poof, and so the diatoms are just willy-nilly, you know, being pushed along. But then when they get to the lake, that's when they can find their true being. And so just that little phrase set me off, because I didn't know what diatoms were. So I started getting these giant tomes of about diatoms from the library, and they were full of these gorgeous pictures. And it turns out that they're very interesting historically, because they were really the inspiration for the development of microscopes originally with, so Leeuwenhoek, I think it was the 17th century, they think it was diatoms. He called them animalcules. He developed the first lenses through which people could see the microscopic. So they were an original inspiration for wanting to see more and developing visual technologies for seeing. So I kind of followed that notion that not only were these beautiful microscopic creatures that we can't see with our naked eye inspiring us to create these microscopes, but that they're also helping to they're producing food, so they're like foundational. And of course, when, like you say, in a book about flooding, who would ever think about diatoms? So this is a way to kind of stretch the kind of terrain in which we're understanding the relationship between water, the surface of water, water bodies, the earth, and human beings, and what we're doing by diverting things and connecting river basins and, you know, flooding lakes. And then there's a whole part about geoscientists who discovered a particular species because of the latest visual type technologies in light microscopy and electron microscopy and all kind of new microscopy, and all these different microscope technologies let you see things differently. So some you can see dead diatoms, and others you can see only live diatoms. And with these different visual technologies, you can see different details. And by seeing different details, you can sort these diatoms into different species. And then you can track these species if you're looking at the dead ones, which are the most powerfully visualized. You can get the dead ones from the sediments of the lake and study the relationship between the lake and the river in ancient geological time. So I think of diatoms as actors and colleagues of scientists who are trying to understand the relationship of Lake Manitoba and the Assiniboine River, for starters. Yeah. They're totally neat. Everybody should go and just Google it and look at pictures of them.
Yeah. Okay. So as we're moving towards the end of our time here, I wanted to give you an opportunity to give a shout out or a thank you to anyone whose help was important to you as you were writing this book.
Okay. Well, as I said, it was years in the making. But of course, without Winnipeg, the wonderful city, such a quixotic city, so cold and so wet and so wonderful. It has a wonderful art scene and the people are lovely. And I want to thank the engineers and the flood, forecasters and the natural resource people, all of these experts who took the time to talk to me, even though they had no idea really where I was coming from or why I was asking these very basic questions and why didn't I just take an engineering 101 class. They were very kind and very helpful, and the book never could have seen the light of day without everything they've taught me, especially Bill Ranney, who took me on two field trips with his geophysical sciences class that were wonderful. I want to thank Pauline Greenhill, who's been my friend since we went to graduate school together in UT Austin. She's a folklorist and a gender studies professor who was the reason that I went to Winnipeg way before I did this project in Winnipeg. And Danny Blair, who came up with the idea of creating this Fulbright research scientist position at the University of Winnipeg. And everybody in Winnipeg, Prabha Pilar, shout out, performance artist who made my time there wonderful. And over the years, right, I love workshops and I've been to a lot of them. And I want to just mention two really pivotal groups that I work with. One, first, it was the Rivers of the Anthropocene group, and Jaya Savitsky, who I already mentioned, they were pivotal in that. And a lot of the geologists who, not a lot, but several of the geologists who were into the Anthropocene and trying to make it a real geological, an official geological epic, not just a cultural phenomena, were there, and historians and artists, and it was a wonderful transdisciplinary space, as they called it, and really pulled me into a way of thinking about rivers that I didn't know about. And Mark Williams too was in that group. And also, and very importantly, when I started thinking about ice seriously, was the Ice Law Project, headed up by the visionary Phil Steinberg at the University of Durham. And I got to work with folks at Dalhousie University in Canada, who is my subgroup. And it was a 3-year project, and we got together in in Durham and in Finland and in Sweden, I think all these different places. And we talked about how international law could come to grips with ICE. And I learned so much. It was another radically interdisciplinary group of people, law, science, arts, humanities, all getting together and thinking about how to push against this notion that the Arctic Ocean is like any ocean and that boats should be able to go through and just break up the ice. And it got me thinking about ice. And so then when I got to Canada and was working in Winnipeg, I had a whole different framework for thinking about ice. And I probably should stop there.
All right. So then that brings us to our traditional final question, which is, what are you working on next?
Okay, so I'm hoping to get another Fulbright to go to Portugal, to Lisbon. And I don't know if you remember, but at the beginning of the interview, I mentioned that when I was in the sciences doing ecology, I was in the Amazon recording birds. That was kind of the not official side of the project. I was supposed to be doing frogs because there wasn't a professor interested in birds. Anyway, I had this thing about birds, and I'm still got this thing about birds. So I'm going back to birds, but so I'm trying to look at all this water stuff, these water ecologies and infrastructure engineering projects from the perspective of birds. So it's called Port City as Avian Habitat. And I'm looking at what I call the interface between the environment, which is a maritime estuary, the Tagus Estuary off the coast of Lisbon, and how the birds fly. It's a key resting and nesting place for the birds, and I forget which flyway, but the birds are coming back and forth from Africa to Northern Europe and stopping in the marsh opposite the opposite coast from Lisbon. All this that I've been talking about, but flipping it entirely to try to get to understand how birds are relating to, for example, this giant bridge that now crosses the Tagus Estuary. And I'm going to be working with scientists who study birds and also hanging out under the bridge and watching them fly around. So I'm looking forward to that if I get it.
All right. Well, that sounds really interesting. And if that turns into a book, we'd love to have you back to talk about it.
Thank you, Stentor. It's been a pleasure. You ask good questions.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, my pleasure.
This has been a conversation with Stephanie C. Kane, author of Just One Rain Away, The Ethnography of River City Flood Control, published last year by McGill Queen's University Press.